We are continuing to look at the resurrection week. And as we were discussing last week, we were just going to try to pick up where we left off. We were talking about, so Jesus has now come to before Pilate a second time. And he's there again, and they're going through this kind of trial, if you will. Where he's being charged by the Sanhedrin, by the Jews, that he has committed treason by claiming to be king, that he's committed treason by telling people not to pay their taxes, and that he is a insurrectionist, not a resurrectionist. That he is, right? Or will be. But an insurrectionist. And so those three charges get laid out. Of course, Pilate has figured out pretty quickly, he did that the first time he was there, figured out that those charges really have no basis in truth, and he has been trying to get out of this. And so he's tried a couple different avenues. First, he tried to send him to Herod and throw him on Herod's doorstep. Of course, that didn't work. Herod then sent him back to Pilate. And now he's going to try a second avenue to get out of this. There's a custom. If you go to Matthew 27 and verse 15, Matthew in his gospel tells us that at the time of the Passover, there was a custom that had developed where the Roman government would offer to the people a prisoner to be released. And so it was a pardon, if you will. Much like, you know, our presidents have pardon power, our governors have pardon power in certain crimes. Well, Pilate had the ability to pardon one of the inmates. So we had begun talking about the guy that they bring out. So I want to look at the different accounts. So we're going to kind of move here. But who is it they bring out? Barabbas, right? Verse 16 tells us that he was a notorious prisoner. In other words, people well knew who he was, what kind of character he was, and so he brings this guy out. Now, in my mind, I think what Pilate is trying to do is he's trying to offer the people one of the worst criminals they could, and say, you know, look at this really bad guy, and then here's Jesus. Don't you want Jesus to be released? I mean, this guy over here, you certainly don't want this guy. So why wouldn't they want him? Well, Matthew doesn't give us a ton about this, but a little bit. But if you go to Mark gives us a little bit more about him. Not only is he a notorious prisoner, but Mark 15 and verse 7, how does Mark describe him?
Rebel.
Says he was among the rebels who had done what?
Murder
and insurrection, right? So, and we've talked in the past, I won't belabor it, but insurrection in the Roman law was a big crime, right? So, notice it's mentioned before murder in one of the accounts. So he's an insurrectionist, a murderer. Then if you go to Luke 23, let's see, Luke 23 and verse 18, or verse 19, we'll go to verse 19. Luke gives us a little bit more information. Luke 23:19 says that he was a man who had been what? Thrown into prison for insurrection, started in the city, and for murder. Again, he's reiterating this idea that he was a direct cause of that insurrection and that murder. Okay, what about John? Does John give us anything? John doesn't get into it as much, but there's something here.
Verse
There's really not anything in John's. I was thinking there's something there. So Barabbas, he's an insurrectionist, murderer. Now, what's kind of fascinating is this this guy Barabbas. Now, from a Jewish standpoint, his name indicates something. You remember what in Matthew 16, how does Jesus, in verse 19, how does he address Simon Peter? Bar-Jonah, right? Remember he calls him Bar-Jonah. Why does he call him Simon Bar-Jonah? What's that? The son of Jonah, right? Bar is that indication. You also see Big James and John are called the sons of thunder at one time, but they're also called the, it's left my mind. Anyway, it refers to their father. They're called Bar. What is their father's name? Somebody help me out with that.
Zebedee,
that's it. Bar, so they're the sons of thunder, Bar, that same term is used in the Greek, sons of Zebedee, Bar Zebedee. So, let's go back to Barabbas. I'm bringing that up too. When you break up Barabbas, it really breaks up into Bar-Rabbas, and or Bar Bar-Abba, more correctly, Bar-Abba. Now, Bar refers to son of. What does Abba mean?
Father.
The father. So his name literally translates to son of the father. Now, that's fascinating. So you've got, on one side, you've got Jesus, the Son of God. And on the other side, you have Barabbas, the Son of the Father. Fascinating picture that God has put forward for us as they stand there. I think I have this next, yeah. So this is just to give us kind of a visualization of what's going on here is you've got Pilate up there from his judgment seat is bringing forward two men, and they have real stark contrast to them. You've got Jesus, who at this point has not been scourged, so this is prior to that, but He's been, you know, went through that mock trial. He's been beaten and spat on. He's standing there with his chains on. As it's been noted, been silent during all of this. He's remained calm. And then on the other side, you have this insurrectionist murderer that I think it's interesting that the text tells us that when Pilate went to get Barabbas, he went among the rebels. So he was very intentional in what he's doing. But then there's the other symbolic picture we're getting. We're having the Son of God taking the place of the Son of the Father. Now, in that picture, where do we stand? We're over here.
Yeah.
We're Barabbas in this illustration. We're not here, right? Jesus took his place. I was listening to a sermon on this, and they were talking about Barabbas, and talking about how that when he was down there in the prison, and he's hearing the crowds and everything, and he's been told that you're going to be brought up, and he's hearing all this commotion. I wonder what he's thinking about. I wonder if he's thinking, well, it's finally here. You know, they're finally going to kill me. And then to come up here and to be next to this other guy whom Pilate knows good and well is innocent. And then to have your release made and the other guy going and receiving the punishment you deserved. See, Barabbas deserved to be crucified. Yet Jesus took his place on the cross. Jesus deserved to be the one to be acquitted that day because he had done nothing wrong. Barabbas did not. Jesus took on himself the stripes which we deserve. These kind of things that just continue to come up in Scripture, I'm amazed about constantly. The shadows and the antitypes that we find throughout the Holy Text. And so you have the crowds there. The text tells us, if you go back into the Gospels there, if you go to Matthew's Gospel, if you go to Matthew 27 and verse 18, the text tells us that Pilate knew what? It was out of envy that Jesus had been delivered up. I mean, he understands what's going on. That's why he's not guiltless in all of this. But all of this is going on. Now, verse 19. Let me back up. Let's start at verse 16. And they had a notorious prisoner called Barabbas. Verse 17. So, when they had gathered, when he brought everybody together, Pilate said to them, "Whom do you want me to release to you? Barabbas or Jesus, who is called the Christ?" For he knew that it was out of envy that they had delivered him up. Besides, while he was sitting on the judgment seat, his wife sent word to him, "Have nothing to do with that righteous man, for I have suffered much because of him today in a dream." Now the chief priests and the elders persuaded the crowds to ask for Barabbas and destroy Jesus. I think that's fascinating too. It doesn't tell us how they persuaded them, but remember what happened just a few days ago when Jesus entered into the town on the back of that small mule. What were the people doing then? They were praising him. They were putting out the palm branches. They're welcoming him as king, as they should have done. And in just a few days, they have now all turned against him. They had been persuaded to call for his death rather than this evil man, Barabbas. So verse 20, the chief priests and the elders persuaded the crowd to ask Barabbas and destroy Jesus. The governor again said to them, "Which of the two do you want me to release for you?" Now you notice that's the second time he's asked this. He's really pushing toward a certain direction. Release to you. And they said, "Barabbas." Pilate said to them, "Then what shall I do with Jesus, who is called Christ?" They all said, "Let him be crucified." And he said, "Why? What evil has he done?" But they shouted all the more, "Let him be crucified." So when Pilate saw that he was gaining nothing, but rather that a riot was beginning, he took water, washed his hands before the crowd, saying, "I am innocent of this man's blood. See to it yourselves." And all the people answered, and I noticed this very prophetic statement, "His blood be upon us and on our children." Then he released for them Barabbas, and having scourged Jesus, delivered him to be crucified. And so Matthew kind of goes through some of this detail kind of quickly, but he emphasizes an important point for a Jewish audience would have been very important. And it was, I think, was two things. Number one, they asked for Jesus to be crucified. It was what they wanted. And then also, prophetically, what did they call for?
"His blood be on us."
And in making that statement, "His blood be upon us and our children," what are they saying? In the moment, what are they saying? Not looking prophetically, but what, when they make that statement, what is their intention behind it? Okay, we'll bear the guilt of this. Because it's obvious that Pilate doesn't want this. And he makes it quite obvious when he washes his hand. "I don't want any part of this." And so they say, "Let us, we'll bear this." It's just all really fascinating. I think about what's going to happen in 50 days from this point forward? What happens in 50 days from the Passover? Is what?
Day of Pentecost, and the Holy Spirit comes on the apostles, and we become completely different people.
Yeah, and you have, I think it is pretty reasonable to assume a lot of those people who are here now crying out, crucify him, are in that crowd in Acts chapter 2, who Peter says in verse 36, let you know for assuredly, you crucified this man. You crucified the Son of God. You did this. And they're crying out here, let his blood be upon us and our children. They obviously do not understand the deep implications of that when they say it, but the meaning is kind of overwhelming.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so when you look at Matthew's gospel, that's really what he's driving at. And so do you see any differences in the other gospels? Well, when you look at Mark's gospel, there's really not much difference. It's very similar. And so we won't look at that. Let's go to John, though. Let's go to Luke for one quick thing. I want to look at one quick thing in Luke. Luke 23:22. Just to emphasize this point of how much Pilate is really trying to get them to give the right answer as he sees it. Luke 23:22. Luke tells us that it was... How many times did he offer them a choice?
Three
different times he tries to urge them to just take Jesus, right? Jesus is the right answer. You take this man. Don't take this guy. Just kind of emphasizing this idea, that's not really what he wanted to do. Let's go to John's gospel. And John gives us some different things, some additional information that I think is important. Again, John is written when? Anybody remember what we said? When is John's gospel written? It's in the 90s, right? Very late 80s, early 90s, somewhere in that time frame. So he's written about 60 years after these events. And why is that important? Well, at the time John is writing, he is writing more generally to whom? What? Well, John's really written to a Christian audience and a more mature church. And really the driver of his is dealing with false teaching, right? One of the big reasons that he's writing. So he's writing not necessarily to a Jewish or a Gentile world, but a Christian world, right? One of the things he includes that the others don't, I won't belabor it, we've looked at it before, but he is the only one that includes all of the discussion on the kingdom. If you go to John 19, John 18, and you begin about verse 35, that's when Jesus and Pilate had this discussion about the kingdom and about its nature. I won't do all that. I've done that in other things. But that's interesting that John includes that, whereas the other Gospels really don't talk about that. So he and Pilate, also in John's gospel, Jesus and Pilate, their conversation is much longer. He includes a lot more about their interactions than do the synoptic gospels. So we have here in the gospels where Pilate has made this choice. You want Jesus or Barabbas? Which one are you going to choose? And of course, the people choose Barabbas, not Jesus. If you go to John 19 and verse 40, they cry out, "Not this man, but Barabbas." Now, John helps us with the timeline here. So when was Jesus scourged? When did Pilate wash his hands? When did those events happen? Well, if you start looking at the Gospels, you start looking through them, John is the one that really helps us to kind of understand the time frame of these things. If you go to John 19 and verse 1, now none of the Gospels speak in detail to the scourging or flogging. But John records one simple verse in John 19 verse 1, "Then Pilate took Jesus and flogged him." Flogged, some may have scourged, some other Gospels use the word scourge, but it's all the same thing. It is kind of important for us to understand contextually what's going on. So when you talk about the concept of crucifixion, and you look into the history of it, who began crucifixion? Do you know?
Romans?
Mm-mm. Well, it was actually, you could have gotten the middle group there. It was the Medo-Persian Empire let's see. Yeah, the Persians that had begun this kind of idea of hanging people on trees. Now, what they did was not like what the Romans did. It looked very different. But you have some record of them doing it. But it was really the Romans who perfected it, if you want to use that term. They're the ones that made it into the sinister tool that it became. What's the purpose in Roman view of crucifixion?
Make an example.
Okay, make example. Let's expand on that. What do we mean by that? Make example for what purpose? What are we doing?
Willing to stand up against the Roman Empire, this is what you get.
Okay.
To discourage insurrection.
To discourage insurrection or any other crime, any other law breaking. You obey the laws, right? Why are people put in prison? Well, part of it is to punish the crime. That's kind of what we're trying to do. But the other purpose is to do what? To deter future crime. And so crucifixion was brutal. If we just look at the crucifixion itself, that's brutal. But you really can't eliminate scourging away from crucifixion. The two went together. Now, when we look at the concept of beating in the Old Testament, were people ever beaten in Jewish law? Jewish law gave permission to do that, right, at times. Now, there was a certain rule where in Jewish beatings, how many times could you whip somebody?
39. 40
less 1. Yeah, so 39, 40 minus 1. And that had been the Jewish custom.
Yeah.
Now, it could be very easy for us to kind of come over into the Roman law and apply that same rule. But the Romans didn't have the 40 minus 1 rule. We have no way of knowing how many lashes Jesus actually took. They were not about adhering to the Mosaic law. They were just beaten. Criminals were how many times the soldiers wanted to beat them. But as far as I know, there's no actual number. Yes?
The Jews didn't use the scourge either.
Mm-mm. So let's talk about, you're talking about the flagrum? The flagrum. Now, when I think of a whip, I usually have the long whip, you know, of the Indiana Jones quality. Right? You remember Indiana Jones? He had on his own. Right? That's not what we're talking about. We're talking about the Roman whip or flagrum. This was a handheld, a little bit shorter device that, as you can tell, this is a drawing of what we think it looked like. We have some artifacts from that time period. But it was had a handle, and then through the handle you'd have these leather thongs that came out of it. And then attached to the leather thongs were different objects. They would often have lead balls, kind of run into the leather. You would also have things like bone shards, and maybe even lead spikes. And so the soldier would take that. The prisoner would come out to us. Now, I've heard different ideas here. I don't know which one is true, so I'm going to take some places I've seen where it was more of a stump, and the guy was laid across the stump, and his hands were fastened, and it's so that his back was most prominent. Others I've seen is where you had a taller pole where you were tied up and suspended from that, and you were laid, with your stomach against the pole. And then they would, of course, come and, whip across the back. Either way, you could see how both would be quite painful. They were beaten with these flagrums. I don't remember the percentage. I meant to look this up before. But most of the time, I think it was about a third of the time, prisoners died from the flagrum, from the scourging itself. Due to blood loss that would be done. And so, one out of three just died there, and then this whole process was over with. I believe it's, I'll double check on the percentage for you. But so I think what that says about more than anything is the brutality of it. It kind of gives us a peek inside of that event. Yes, Roger?
The 40, according to the law of Moses, the limit was 40.
But they Yeah, but again, Romans didn't adhere to Mosaic law, so they wouldn't have cared about the 40. They would just beat you until they were done. So,
one less because it
just they didn't want to violate the law. Yeah. But here, that wasn't the case. And so later on, when Jesus has trouble carrying his cross, one of the things we have to keep in mind is he's endured a great deal of blood loss and muscle damage. So just think about that as you get to that point. And so they would flog you. You go through that process. Now, one of the things they did in Jesus' instance that I'm not sure was the case always was not only did they flog him, but what did they do after? Or it was just prior to it, what did they do to him? They mocked him. Do you remember? They put the purple robe on him. They made the crown of thorns. And I've often wondered where that purple robe came from, because that fabric was very expensive. But at least in my mind, I kind of solved that issue. Because if you remember, when we studied, when he went before Herod, what did Herod do before he sent him back? He dressed him up to mock him. And so to me, that's a reasonable conclusion that robe, that's the robe they're using. I just want to emphasize that having purple fabric, that kind of fabric, would have been very expensive. And so when you get to, is it Lydia, that's the seller of the fine linen, I mean, what she was doing was something that was very valuable in the first century. So as a part of all this process, that verse 2 of John 19 tells us the soldiers twisted together a crown of thorns and put it on his head and arrayed him in a purple robe. And they came up to him saying, "Hail, King of the Jews!" and struck him with their hands. All right, so all that takes place. So that man who came before Pilate when Barabbas was there, the man who comes back to Pilate is not the same, does not look the same. He probably had some bruises from the beating he endured last night, maybe some other beatings that occurred. But what he endured in the scourging was much more severe than anything he had endured to that point. And so you can, for a minute, try to imagine in your mind what he would have looked like. And he would have been a man who had endured a great deal of pain. And so he is sent to be scourged. Let's see. If you're looking at John, this is why I'm telling you John's real important here. He gives us more the sequence of events. So we've already talked about it. I won't go back. But when Jesus is actually sent for crucifixion, and when the people cry out again for another time to be crucified, that comes after the scourging. And so I think in scourging him, one of the things that Pilate had hoped was that now, as he offers him again to the people, maybe they're going to take sympathy on him at this point and cry out for something different. But notice what the text says. Go to John 19 and verse 4. Pilate went out again and said to them, "See, I am bringing him out to you that you may know that I find no guilt in him." Why did you scourge him? You're admitting to a crime. You've scourged an innocent man. But Rome really wouldn't care because he's not a Roman. But he says, "I find no guilt." So verse 5 tells us, "So Jesus came out wearing the crown of thorns and the purple robe." He's even humiliated him. Not only is he, I imagine, has to be in obvious pain. A man who, I'm amazed he's standing, but here he is. But now he's even put on this mock array, or the soldiers put on this mock array on him. And there he stands. Yet the crowd has not lost their vehementness of hatred against him. Verse 6 says, "When the chief priests and the officers saw it, they cried out, 'Crucify him! Crucify him!' Pilate said to them, 'Take him yourselves and crucify him, for I find no guilt in him.' And the Jews answered, 'We have a law, and according to that law, he ought to die because he made himself the Son of God.'" When Pilate heard this statement, he was even more afraid. I don't know if I've ever seen any kind of film depict that really the way it was. Why is he so interested in trying to, on multiple occasions, get out of this? Well, John seems to allude, the Holy Spirit through John alludes to the fact he's afraid. Just an interesting note there. Verse 9, he entered his headquarters again and said to him, "Where are you from?" But Jesus gave him no answer. Isaiah 53, right? Like a sheep before its shears is quiet, silent, so is the Son of God. So Pilate said to him, "You will not speak to me? Do you know that I have authority to release you and authority to crucify you?" Jesus answered him. I wonder what this must have sounded like. Jesus answered him, "You would have no authority over me at all unless it had been given you from above. Therefore, he who delivered me over to you has the greater sin." From then on, Pilate sought to release him. So he's still seeking a way to release him. But the Jews cried out, "If you release this man, you are not Caesar's friend. Everyone who makes himself a king opposes Caesar." So when Pilate heard these words, he brought Jesus out, sat down on the judgment seat at the a place called the Stone Pavement in Aramaic, Gabbatha. Now it was the day of preparation. It was about the sixth hour. And he said to the Jews, "Behold your king." They cried out, "Away with him! Away with him! Crucify him!" Pilate said to them, "Crucify your king." The chief priest answered, "We have no king but Caesar." So he delivered him over to them to be crucified. And so at one point in there, you know, they're calling for him to be crucified. He washes his hands and says, "You take him." And that's what they do. Any questions about that? We went over a lot there. A lot happening. All right, as we move forward, he is sent to be crucified. There's a lot for us to cover. I'm not going to try to start that today. But if you'll go ahead and read the rest of Matthew 27, the other Gospels accounts, that'll be good for us as we move forward in our discussion. We'll talk about another kind of time question that we need to deal with as far as when the crucifixion began and when it ended. And we'll talk about how we should study that and what does the information tell us. But we will look at that next week. And we'll look at the crucifixion itself, that kind of process that was ongoing there. Bible doesn't answer all the questions for us that we might have, but we've, through archaeology, gotten a few answers about what possibly could have happened. All right. Again, thank you all so much. We'll continue on next Wednesday night. Thank you. We'll be closed now for our devotional and begin that in just a few minutes. Thank you.